Let's start, Paul, with the Russian economy right now. The Prime Minister of Russia reported that their GDP grew by 5% in 5 months. The question is how Russia could sustain such an economy, even grow during this conflict, more than 2 years of this conflict in Ukraine, how they could manage that, in your opinion?
Well, I don't think they're putting many resources into the conflict. Probably it's their energy and their grain. Plus, the sanctions forced Russia to give up on this globalism idea. So instead of developing economies for other countries, which is what globalism does, they're developing their own. So I would imagine that's the answer. The surprise to me is that they can grow at all when the central bank has a 16% interest rate. So this is a surprise. How in the world, with a 16% interest rate, the economy is growing at 5%? I don't know the answer.
Yeah. And when you look at the SCO summit and the reflection of this summit in the Western media, we haven't heard anything. They were not mentioning anything about the SCO summit. But everything you see in the NATO summit is a reflection of what was going on at the SCO summit. And the importance of this summit, Paul, was that China and India decided to bring some sort of sanity to their relationship. Last time we talked, you've been mentioning that these problems between China and India were so childish. It seems that they are now willing to negotiate, to talk about these things, and they said it at the SCO summit.
Yes, that's a hopeful development. I would imagine that Putin put a lot of pressure on both of them to reconcile their silly back and forth over nothing. Clearly, if China and India are at loggerheads, there can't be this reforming of the world, the reforming into a multipolar world. So it had to stop. And I think Putin had a very successful meeting with the leader of India. And he, of course, has been meeting often with the leader of China. So I think Putin has probably succeeded in making them see the necessity of stopping this nonsense between them, because what's at stake is far beyond the little issue that they have.
In your opinion, right now, what's going on between India, Russia, and China? Is there any hope for the United States to separate India from China and Russia?
Well, you never know. It depends on how corrupt members of the Indian government are, because generally speaking, the way the United States separates countries is with money. Washington can go in and offer to make any members of the Indian government very rich. You're talking about giving them $50 million, $100 million. And so if the members of the government are corrupt, and the leader himself, then Washington can simply buy them, simply purchase them. Other than that, there doesn't seem to be any real way, because India is right there. There's Russia right next to India. There's China right there. And this is part of the world that India lives in. And so it needs to get along with this part of the world. It has no future in a war with Russia or a war with China. And the development of that whole area, which should quickly exceed that of the Western world, is at stake if they don't get along and work out cooperative relationships. So it'd be very difficult, I think, for Washington to break it off, except through the corruption of the Indian political leaders.
Do you think that we see something so amazing right now in the SCO summit, in the BRICS, that countries who have differences like China and India, Iran and Saudi Arabia, India, Pakistan, they're joining in a some sort of partnership that they can put aside their differences and they can work together. Do you see anything of some of this type of behavior would happen to the European Union, to the United States, G7?
Well, the European Union, it's a different kind of relationship from what the Russians are building with BRICS. And of course, NATO is basically a Washington-dominated arrangement. I think Europe is long accustomed to being lights of Washington, you know, agents of Washington. They're not sovereign nations when it comes to their economic policy, to their foreign policy. There's no such thing as a sovereign European nation or British. France under de Gaulle, under Charles de Gaulle, was the last sovereign European country. And of course, he was gone when? In 1959. And but even then, France stayed out of NATO for a long time. It took Washington some time to corrupt the French government and make them give up their sovereignty. But for Putin, the sovereignty of countries is important. So he's not trying to impose some sort of unilateralism over the BRICS the way Washington imposes it over Europe and Canada and Australia and Great Britain. So the organization of BRICS is not a threat to the sovereignty of the nations. And I think these nations, because they still are nations, they have sovereignty, they see all sorts of advantages in this arrangement because India, Russia, and China, these are massive countries. China and India, in terms of population, Russia, in terms of land mass. And militarily, it's an enormous power. So the advantages of being in BRICS are far greater than being in NATO, where you have no sovereignty and you follow orders. And apparently, Washington basically subordinates the economies of Europe to its own. And so they're not doing well. You know, the sanctions have basically punished Europe, particularly Germany, not Russia. And you don't get this type of treatment from BRICS. So I think whatever the difficulties that can arise internally, the benefits are real and they will work out these difficulties. This is how I think Putin understands the multi polarity, where we work things out. We don't make threats. We don't impose this. We don't do that. And I think that has far more promise than the EU or the NATO arrangement.
And when you look at Putin's visit to North Korea. Right now, China's army is in Belarus. And on one side, on the other side, you see Australia, New Zealand, and South Korea and Japan were invited to the NATO summit. Are we heading to some sort of escalations in terms of the conflict between Russia and China on one side and NATO on the other side?
Well, Washington is clearly intense conflict. I mean, the whole Ukrainian conflict was orchestrated by Washington. I mean, we blame Washington blames Russia, but this was produced by Washington. And now we see that the non-governmental organizations that Washington funds in Georgia, a former province of Russia, that they're now trying to stir up a color revolution to open a second front against Russia. We see the delivery of the fighter jets, the long-range missiles. We see the reduction of restraints on their use. We see hostile language continuing toward Russia. We see reports of American bases in Finland, of American intermediate range missiles being put in Europe. So clearly, it's the intent of Washington to proceed, to go forward with these aggressive moves. And how Putin will eventually respond to these, I don't know. They may just continue to ignore them. It's not necessarily a wrong strategy, though I think by ignoring all these hostile moves, Putin really encourages more of them. So there could just get to be too many. We'll just have to see. I wrote to this morning, I said, why is the West preparing for war? You see, in Washington, both the House of Representatives and the Senate are preparing legislation to bring back the military draft. That is conscription. They can't raise enough troops with a volunteer army for the kind of aggression they have in mind. So they're going to bring back conscription. We haven't had that for decades. This is an indication they're preparing for war. What else could it be? It was Trump who pulled out of the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Missile Treaty. Now, this treaty was signed by Reagan and Gorbachev. Reagan described it as a great step toward peace. And the result of this treaty was that the United States and the Soviet Union destroyed somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000 nuclear warheads. They took them out of service and destroyed them. And it was the first real nuclear arms destruction program. And it halted the arms race in a dangerous level. And now all this has been thrown aside. And we're now making these missiles, deploying them in Europe. So why? What is the purpose of this type of aggressive maneuvers when the weapons are so destructive? These are highly destructive weapons. And for Washington, for Trump himself, to overturn all of the tension reduction agreements achieved during the Cold War by a series of American presidents and a series of Soviet leaders. There were decades in which they passed arms limitation agreements. They were doing all sorts of things to build trust, to reduce tensions, and now all we have is more and more tensions. And Washington is responsible. Washington blames Russia or China when, but it's Washington who's doing this. It wasn't Russia who broke up the INF Treaty. It wasn't Russia who pulled out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. It's been going on in the United States ever since Clinton, when he broke the promise that NATO would not move to Russia's borders. Well, so since the 1990s, Washington has been progressively destroying all the work done in the 20th century to reduce tensions and build trust. Well, it makes no sense because, to repeat myself, nuclear weapons, especially those today, are just massively destructive. And you don't ever want to produce a war that could end up in the use of such weapons. And yet Washington does. They seem to be committed. Whether it's insanity, just satanic evil, or just some sort of hegemonic ambition, or all three.
When you look at this, Stoltenberg said in his recent interview, he said the reason that NATO invited these four countries, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and South Korea, is because of China that is helping Russia in this conflict. And that's because of China that Russia is doing well right now. And it seems that they're shifting the rhetoric toward China right now. And we've learned that Russian and Chinese military exercises in the southern China, and they're preparing for any sort of escalation if something happens.
Well, I think they're trying to isolate Russia from China by making accusations to China. If you noticed when the accusation at the NATO summit was made, that China was a decisive enabler of Russia's war with Ukraine, and that as a consequence, China was a danger to our, they meant American, to Washington's interest in security. They're trying to imply that China, you better move away from Russia or, we're going to start putting sanctions on you. We'll find some way to try to muck up your economy or. Now, I think these are empty threats because I don't think the United States really has that capability, and it would only accelerate the move away from the use of the dollar, thus worsening inflation problems in the United States. But I think that's what it is. They're trying to put some distance between Russia and China. And I thought the Chinese response was very weak because what China did, they said, well, we're not sending him any weapons. A better response would have been, oh, we're thinking about sending them 500,000 of our best troops. Oh, we're thinking about calling up 2 million more men in the army. Now that would stop the war. But instead, they said, oh, don't accuse us. It's not our fault. We're not giving him anything. It was such a weak response. It made me wonder if the intimidation of China was going to work. I don't know what explains that weak response. Particularly if it's true the Chinese have some troops in Belarus conducting maneuvers. If that's the case, they should have said, oh, we're sending more troops. You don't get anywhere with the West by denying the accusations, because the West already knows the accusations are false. And they're making the accusations to intimidate you. And if you show you're intimidated, well, then the accusations get worse. And so I think this was a stupid response that China made. I don't know what explains it. And like I say, I don't know how to reconcile it with the fact if it's true that the Chinese have troops in Belarus.
You talk about the petrodollar. Recently, we've learned that Saudi Arabia, after 50 years of that agreement between the United States and Saudi Arabia, they just didn't want to extend that deal. And right now, they're talking about Saudi Arabia has hinted to the European Union that it will sell Western bonds if G7 countries confiscate $300 billion in Russian assets. You see how the behavior of Saudi Arabia is changing in the Middle East. How do you, what's your understanding on what's going on in the Middle East?
Yes, well, I wouldn't know what to say other than I think the Saudis are losing confidence in Washington and have come to the conclusion they're out on the end of the limb with a country that may be failing, one that they're losing confidence in. And so they're trying to broaden their base rather than just be dependent on the United States. They're trying to, which is a long ways away. And also, of course, the Russian oil. This makes the Saudi and the Russians have a common interest in the price of oil and its shipments in the markets. So there's more for the Saudis to look forward to and the relationships there than there are with Washington. For the longest time, the petrodollar, the Saudi requirement that all payments be made in dollars. This was a huge supporter of the American national debt because it created the demand for the treasury bonds that Washington was issuing to cover its debt. So this is a blow to the dollar. And Washington keeps inviting these blows by so openly serving only its own interest. If you notice, Putin is very careful not to do that. He talks about our interest, and he means the BRICS, the non-Western world. And whereas for the West, our interest is Washington's interest. And so I suspect that that's the answer to the Saudis. The Muslim world has always been weak because of the difference between the two Muslim groups that go back to the time of Muhammad's successor. And this has kept them split. And they've been more opposed to one another than they have been to their conquerors. So they were easy to colonize because there was no unity. And this unity, of course, has played into Israel's hands. So the Israel state has been able to insert itself there since 1947 and succeed. And now it's slaughtering other Muslims, and the Muslims don't do anything about it. So the weakness of the Muslim world is historical, and they don't seem capable of reconciling that. And therefore, they remain a very weak people, and the governments are weak, and basically, they don't function as a countervailing power to Israel. There's only Iran, and Iran is extremely cautious and careful. We'll see if Israel attacks Hezbollah, if they actually go into southern Lebanon. We'll see what happens. We'll see what Iran does. If nothing, Israel might prevail. I just don't know. So that whole area is, it really doesn't have leadership. And it can't have it because of these historical animosities between the two groups of Muslims.
When you look at the recent article in The Lancet, they're reporting that the casualties, the people who have been killed during this conflict in Gaza, is at least 186,000. It's unbelievable, Paul, when you look at 8% of the people in Gaza. How is that possible? And nobody's talking about it.
Well, it seems to me the number couldn't be that small. If you look at the rubble, the whole place is rubble. Everything is destroyed. All the infrastructure is destroyed. The water systems, there are no hospitals. Everything is destroyed. Israel blocks food shipments. So how can it only be 186,000? I don't, it must be a half a million at least, or could be more. You know, when all those apartment buildings collapse and there are people in them, I mean, and you want to know, why does the world stand for this? Well, Israel has bought a lot of the world. It simply buys them. It buys us. We give them the money with which they buy us. We give Israel billions of dollars every year, and they use the money to get their people elected in our elections. They do the same thing throughout Europe. So the United States supplies the billions of dollars to Israel that Israel uses to purchase the governments of the Western world. So who's going to do anything about them? Moreover, they have succeeded over the years in defining any criticism of Israel as anti-Semitism. And that means you're a Nazi. So you see now, even to say, to protest the slaughter in Gaza, it means you're anti-Semitic, and the pressure is on the American university presidents to punish the students for protesting the deaths of the Palestinians. Well, so you, this answers your question. Israel owns the Western world. And you, if you're a politician and you go against them, you're finished. You're simply finished. And now, even if you're a student, you'll get kicked out of Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Stanford and everywhere. So that's the answer, I think, is There's no integrity, there's no character in the leadership anywhere in the West. Where is there a person of character, of integrity? Where? They can all be bought. It's just a place where the different interest groups buy and sell the politicians. That's what the West is. If Israel doesn't own them, the military security complex owns them. If the military security complex and Israel don't own them, the pharmaceutical companies own them.
We know that during this conflict in Gaza, Israelis, to justify what they're doing in Gaza, they were talking about 1,200, 1,500 people that were killed on October 7th. Right now, there is an article in Israeli media Haaretz that they're talking about that Israeli army was responsible for killing those people on October 7th. How do you find the behavior on the part of the Israeli government? Why they did that, in your opinion? And what's the, if they do that to their people, and we can imagine they don't care about anybody in the Gaza Strip.
Well, those articles have come out several times. There have been several of these reports. And the explanation why the Israelis kill their own people was they made a decision to destroy the Hamas invaders, if we want to call them invaders, at all cost, which meant including the hostages they had with them. Israel didn't want any Hamas escaping with Israeli hostages. And so that was the basis for the decision. As best I remember, this is the explanation of Israeli army personnel themselves, that they were called to wipe out that area. And if the Israelis were there, they were just part of the casualties. Now, but we have even more revealing information in Haaretz and elsewhere in Israel that the Israeli government had plenty of advance warning of the attack, that they knew the attack was in the works. And we also have statements from Israeli intelligence officers and from commanders or former commanders of sections of the wall, the barrier, that it's impossible to even approach the wall without the alarms going off. And that it's totally impossible to penetrate it without alarms going off. And yet, we had a situation where the wall was penetrated, no alarms. We had a situation where there were no patrols, despite the fact that the government had advanced warning. So if you look at it, it looks like that was this a Hamas plot or was this an Israeli plot? Because clearly, what did Netanyahu do? He used it, first of all, to get himself out of trouble because he's in serious political and legal trouble at home. You know, he's indicted inside Israel, but they can't get him if he's the prime minister. So here we have a war. Well, they're not going to remove the prime minister in the middle of a war. And it's a war that for Netanyahu, he thinks, okay, this lets me get rid of Gaza. I can get rid of Palestine. And for all times, the whole place will be Israel. And this will make me such a national hero, they'll have to drop the charges. This is clearly what he was thinking. He was also saying, and I can get all those stupid Americans here. And as soon as we finish Hamas and Gaza, We'll get Iran. I can do something that provokes the Americans to join us into attacking Iran, and we'll be rid of Iran, and then we will rule the Middle East. Well, this was the plan. I'm sure of it. I mean, why else was there immediately on the scene two American carrier task forces, a division of American troops, all sorts of American fighter jets? They were just there almost immediately. Well, what for? Certainly not to be used in Gaza. To be used for what? Iran. So I think it was all organized in this way. And what has happened is Israel has found that getting rid of Hamas isn't all as easy as they thought it would be, no matter how much they've destroyed Gaza. And I think Israel was surprised at the extreme criticisms that arose, even in the United States, which is bought and paid for by Israel. And even in the Biden administration, where Biden has at least publicly had to look like he's opposed to this and is trying to lessen it. And of course, there were the outbreaks of the students in the universities. So I saw not long ago an article by an Israeli officer or former officer. And he said that Israel can't defeat Hamas and that they won't be defeated. So, what will Netanyahu do if this is the case? Or if he's blocked from driving the remnants of the Palestinians into Egypt, which was a plan they had? Will he now turn on Lebanon? Just to get the focus off the failure to get rid of Hamas. Who knows? Who knows? But he's clearly, I think, a dangerous and deranged person. And I think he's fighting for himself. And so it remains a very dangerous situation. It could get a lot worse if conflict extends into Lebanon. It'll almost have to extend into Iran. So, if Iran, of course, abandons Hezbollah, well, then there goes Iran's prestige. So, it's a extremely dangerous situation. It's not worked out the way Netanyahu thought, but he hasn't given up.
But Iran said that they're not gonna leave Hezbollah alone. They're gonna be there with everything they have to support Hezbollah if Israel attacks Hezbollah. And we know that in that attack of Iran on Israel, they have just saturated the air defense system of Israel, and they hit the air bases in Israel, some points in they wanted to hit. And in that defense system, Israel was cooperating with the United States, United Kingdom, Jordan. Many countries were helping Israel to defend itself against Iran, but they have failed, as we talk with military experts here on this podcast. And do you think if they go fighting Hezbollah without the United States, is that possible for Israel to win the conflict?
Well, it wasn't in the past. There were two previous occasions, if memory serves, where the Israelis went in to occupy southern Lebanon and they got driven out by Hezbollah. Quite badly defeated by the Hezbollah militia and driven out. And they haven't tried it since. They've tried getting us to attack Iran. You see, the reason 9/11 was used to attack in the Middle East, for the United States to attack, was to rid Hezbollah of its supporters, Iraq, Syria, Iran. Because if Hezbollah didn't have the support of Syria and Iran and Iraq, they wouldn't have the financing or the weapons to withstand Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon. And so that's what the so-called war on terror was all about. It was getting rid of Israel's, of the countries that finance and equip Hezbollah. So we got rid of Iraq. We were about to invade Syria. You may remember Obama said, okay, they've crossed our red line, we're going to invade. But the next morning, the Russian Air Force was there, which stopped the American invasion. And of course, our Congress is full of madmen who want to attack Iran. You know, there's many of them, Senator, both parties, Democrats, Republicans, because they're speaking for Israel. So the pressure on Iran continues, at least in terms of the vocabulary used by the United States government. And of course, Israel does everything it can to provoke an American attack on Iran. So that was the reason for the 20 years of wars that the United States conducted in the Middle East. It was to get rid of Hezbollah's enablers so that Israel could take southern Lebanon. They want the water resources. There's a river there. They need the water. And they want the expansion, because they still have this view of a greater Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates. That's a Zionist goal. And they say it is. You know, you may remember not long ago, Netanyahu was holding up the maps showing greater Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates. He was on TV holding them. Now, see, here in the United States, they all deny that there's any such greater Israel, but there he was holding up the mass. So this is a important feature in the equation. Of course, we pretend that there's no such thing as a Zionist view of greater Israel, but there most certainly is. And pretending that it's not, it simply leaves people uninformed, and then have no expectations of what really is driving events. So all of this is not over, and how it ends, I have no idea.
Paul, to wrap up this session, Turkey is very important country. It's in many aspects when it comes to the Israel, to the conflict in Gaza. They're supplying Israel with gas that comes from Azerbaijan, goes through Turkey and then to Israel. They're part of NATO and not part of the EU. And they're asking to join BRICS. Right now, they're asking to join the SCO. And they said that if NATO wants to fight Russia, they're not going to be with NATO. They're not going to be part of this operation. They're not going to fight Russia. How do you understand the behavior of Turkey?
I don't know. I've often puzzled, having noticed these things. The leader there seems to be all over the map, saying one thing, and then he contradicts it with another, and so on and so on. And it could be he doesn't know what's happening and is stressed and doesn't know how he should be aligned or who he can really trust. For the longest time, the czarist government in Russia wanted Constantinople. They want the control of the straits. They if actually it was one of the reasons for World War One. So it could be that he just doesn't know, and he's stressed. On the other hand, it could be he's just looking for the best deal he can get. So he gets up close to one side and the other, and he's asking the Americans, and what he's waiting on is the Americans to say, "Okay, here's $1 billion. Be a good boy for a while. Is this enough that you'll be a good boy for a while?" It could be he's just trying to get more money, or he's trying to get a better deal. Or it could be he's come to the conclusion that in a war, he'd be better off if he's not attacking Russia. The president of Hungary and the president of Slovakia, they've said, "We're not going to participate in any war against Russia." So, and Serbia. The president of Serbia said the same thing. So it could be it's just that they losing confidence in Washington. And if you watch President Biden's debates and news conferences, my word, I mean, who would have confidence? I mean, he confuses Zelensky with Putin. He says he's the first black female president. What does the world think? I mean, how can this country with this kind of leader be of any count? I mean, it has to make people who are on the fence wonder, is it time to get off the fence and get away from the American side? We still don't know who the Democrats are going to run in November. Well, we're getting close to November not to know who the candidate is. I think the way the system works, Nima, they have to have somebody by August the 7th. So that's less than, if that's true, that's less than a month. Well, who's it going to be? I mean, where are there any Democrat leaders? Hillary Clinton. How reassuring will that be? So, it could be, it may be the reason that Putin and the Chinese president are so content just to accept provocations and don't do anything. Is they're watching a total collapse of the United States. And they may say, why should we do anything? They're destroying themselves. So what we should do is just ignore the insults, avoid war, and see if they don't ruin it for themselves. That may be what's going on. That certainly would explain why Putin ignores provocations that in other times and other leaders would have led to war by now. Maybe he just thinks the United States isn't going to be around that much longer. But, I mean, if you think about it, look, imagine if the Democrats steal the election again. Will there be chaos inside the United States? Will the people accept it again? I mean, why do anything before you find that out? I see Putin saying, "Oh, let's wait and see what they do. Let's see what the election does, what the response is. Let's see if the Europeans keep rejecting the ruling parties." If so, what if somebody gets in who wants to withdraw from NATO? Will this begin the breakup? If Marine Le Pen had ended up winning, she's the one who talked about getting out of NATO. Well, you can see if I was Putin, I would say, well, let's wait and see if she wins. So with all these things going on, there's a good reason for the Russians and the Chinese just to win, to wait and see. Because they may not need to do anything. And why risk a terrible war that would do terrible destruction and be pointless? So I think we can have some hope that that might be what's going on. In which case, we can say, well, if the West removes itself, there'll be no war.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Paul, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Yes, it's always a pleasure to be interviewed by you, Nima. Thank you.